Hello and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Remember, we are available on the Financial Mail online and on the Apple and Spotify podcast platforms as well. Typically, the South African news cycle is hectic. Whether it's bullying judges at the JSC, burning down famous buildings, running immigrants out of the country, or just insulting each other, the news is on fire all the time. On the energy front, Minerals and Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe has begun to flag loudly, in case no one's listening, that he believes foreign funders are engaged in a plot to cripple our economy, as local activist groups chalk up court victories against old fossil fuel energy sources like coal and oil and gas that he prefers. It's easy to make fun of Mantashe and easy to forget in the process that he's very powerful, and sometimes to forget that he may actually have a point. So I have as my guest today David Nichols, former chief nuclear officer at Eskom, and now chairman of NECSA, the Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa, and regulator of the nuclear industry here. I love talking to this guy. I once asked him if he had any fears about the safety of nuclear power, and his answer shut me up really quickly. No, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, David, so forgive me. I was chief engineer on a nuclear submarine in the Royal Navy, and I sat on the reactor in heavy seas. David, welcome to Podcast from the Edge, and I apologize if I did exaggerate your underwater life. And I know we agreed we'd talk more widely than nuclear on this podcast, but I want to ask you first off, in 2017, opponents of the Zuma administration's plans to acquire nuclear power plant from Russia successfully had the process halted by the courts. In your view, five years on now, was that a good thing?
Well, first a correction, Peter. First of all, a correction. The nuclear program at the time, despite all the hullabaloo, was actually an open tender process. The Russians might well have won, but they might well not have won. So it was an open tender process. So, yeah, it was a mistake. We are now sitting with a desperate shortage of power, and it's going to get worse in the next 8 years. Or we can do little about that.
When you say we can do little about it, is that because we didn't take the nuclear option when it was on the table?
I didn't think nuclear option, but the point is it takes about 10 years to move, in any major project, to move from a decision to do it to the actual power into the grid. And so anything we now do is going to come online in the late, in 2030 onwards. And our crisis is going to be getting worse till then. Also, by the way, NECSA does not regulate the nuclear industry. That's NNR. That's not. Ah. We get regulated by them, so we aren't in that game.
Well, we'll come back to NECSA because it's interesting. But yeah, let's just talk. Let's just talk energy because I know you've got strong views on where we should be and what we should be doing.
Well, I think if I might, and you've asked me to, you give me a very open discussion. I'll put the current belief system says that renewables are the cheapest and the way to go, and that everyone says. And it's very interesting. Last year, the government went out to tender for two different projects. One was the renewable energy IPP bid window 5, and one was the risk mitigation IPP program. And everyone points at the risk at the REIPP 5, which came in at the lowest one was at 40 cents. Whether they'll close or that's a different discussion, but 40 cents a unit, which clearly is a very good price. And everyone says, you see, renewables are cheaper. And then you've got the risk mitigation IPP, which came in at the lowest was over 1 rand 40. And the upper range was at 1 rand 70, 1 rand 80. And everyone says, you see, that's the nasty, vicious power ships. But the trouble is that the RMIPP was actually completely technology neutral. It just said, you've got to make power for us quickly, and you've got to do it whatever cost is. But you've got to produce power when we want the power produced. In other words, it must be dispatchable. Whereas the REIPP bid window 5 was we want wind or and solar. So they're two exactly in the time frame, the same time frame, same technology cost. And what you're looking at is the difference in the cost of pure energy. That is, I want a lump of energy given to me sometime whenever you feel like it, to power on demand, which is, and the difference is clearly something like 1 rand more expensive. And so there we're sitting in a situation which says the current viewpoint that is politically correct, which is that renewables are a solution with a little bit of gas and that's really the cheapest option, is not being borne out by the reality on the ground. And you can see it also because I heard from a little source that for this 100 megawatt IPPs, there's actually been no applications yet. None. And the reason is very simple. Because if you turn around to me and say, I'm a mine, I want a 40 megawatt supply, which is the obvious thing everyone's talking about. I'm saying 40 megawatts, whatever it is. You turn around and say, okay, 140 megawatt supply. That's great. I'll put PV panels up. And then you say, but what happens when the sun's not shining? So you've got to go to Eskom and say to Eskom, I need a backup contract which guarantees 40 megawatts when the sun is not shining. And the trouble is that the actual cost of power, you and I are both sitting in rooms with lights above us, and we're both paying around R2.50 a unit. I'm guessing a number here, but let's say R2.50 a unit, of which 250 cents is the price of energy. R2 is the capacity factor, the ability to produce it when you want it. So the reason no one has gone for the 100 megawatt renewable projects, because that's fine as long as you only want to mine when the sun's shining. And you can't ask Eskom to be available to supply when your main supplier falls over at the current tariff, because the current tariff is not geared around that. So what we're looking at is a structural problem of understanding of the power system. And everyone's missing these other features that they assume. Because if people tell me, and they do tell me, but the future is small mini grids and Eskom's a dinosaur, and that is a standard sort of statement in many cases, that's fine. In which case we don't need Eskom, in which case we'll shut Eskom down. Like Telkom is now in danger of being shut down completely. But who cares? And the answer is nobody's replacing Eskom. They're cherry picking the bits they like out of it.
So David, how does this all resolve itself? I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, and if Eskom were to close down tomorrow, we'd all be in terrible trouble. I think there's somebody made a calculation about how many hours of no electricity it would take for the country just to revert to, the jungle in terms of our behavior. It's not very many days. So how do we resolve as a society the politically correct options and the harsh reality, as you describe it, of, the fact that nobody's applying for the 100 megawatt, IPP because it's one too expensive and if you're going to do solar, there's no solar at night when you are 2,000 feet down underground digging. What's the answer?
Well, I think you've got to go back to the beginning, if I may, Peter. I'm sorry to go drag you back into a bit of history, but I think it's important to understand that the time frame of the response time of the utility is like 15, 20 years. So decisions you make now will have an effect 10 to 15 years in the future. They have little effect next week. And the problem was that in the middle of the 1990s, there was a politically correct view in the world that the dinosaurs of the power industry were the regulated utilities, and we should go to the free market. The free market would drive this beautifully. And so what really happened is there was a belief that the model that the world had from the 1920s through to the 1980s, which was that of a centrally regulated either state or semi-state utility, was inappropriate for the future. And so it was closed down. And this country was closed down by the 98 energy policy, which said Eskom will build no more power stations. The free market will do it. And I'll use this as an example, but it applies elsewhere. California is now having load restrictions. And California is not a poor country, and they pay a lot more power than we do, and they've got load restrictions going on because of their design of their grid system. The UK just had its power its tariffs increased by 52%. And about half their distribution companies go bankrupt. So the model is not too stable at the moment in the world. But let's go back to South Africa. So what happened to us was in 98, Eskom was told, do not build new power stations, do not build anything, the free market will build it. And so Eskom was then withdrawn from the marketplace. Eskom was corporatized, in the sense we had three different divisions, which had their own boards, exactly as they're doing it now. And Eskom was told not to build. So Eskom aggressively brought down its headcount, closed down its engineering organizations, closed down its project management organizations, and waited for someone to apply to provide power to a customer through the grid, and nobody did. And then in 2004, Alec Irwin became Minister of Public Enterprises, And I understand that he went to ESCOM and he said, excuse me, I've read the 90 energy policy and it says that we can be out of power in 2007. Is that still true? And ESCOM said, yes, the load growth projections still carry on. We're still growing about 3.5% a year demand growth. So yeah, that's still true. And he said, well, okay, what are you doing to stop the lights going out in 2007? And ESCOM said, we've been told to do nothing. We've explicitly been, the free market is supposed to do this. And so the answer was quite simply, ESCOM said, Alec Irwin said, well, what's the free market doing? Nothing. So the answer was, well, shouldn't you build ESCOM? And in about 3 months, ESCOM went from having got a single person in the company whose job description included plan and build new power stations to be instructed to go and build the two biggest plants then virtually in the world. And within 24 months, we're on site with bulldozers. And you may wonder why any project that starts that way, you've got a problem. And I heard said, I may be untrue, but I heard said that the original estimate amount of concrete in Medupi was 1/3 of the final value. Right?
Yeah.
There was no planning because there was no planning because we've been told not to plan.
So catastrophe.
Catastrophe. And then at the end of 2008, ESCOM said, okay, we're back in the builds again. We'll start building up our industry. We'll start getting things going. And ESCOM in 2008 said we had then planned to build nuclear one, nuclear two, coal three, coal four, the second pump storage scheme. There's a whole pile of planning of what's doing. That essentially was abandoned at the end of 2008 because the tariff structure didn't support us to do that. So we've been struggling with ESCOM capacity, sitting with no capacity on it. So to answer your question of what do we have to do, we have to go back and revisit that and realize that, and this is a very controversial statement, that the world's belief that the free market forces will keep the lights on is no more true now than it was in 1930. That you've got an industry which has a product with a millisecond lifespan. In other words, the generation capacity in this country 1 second ago was what's making the light now. You can't store it, essentially. Or you can build machines to store it, but they're expensive. That your investment cycle is 15, 20 years in the future. And that it's a utility for society. It's not something which you can assume will come to play. Because the other problem that's fundamental to the economy and is destroying the economy is that building an industrial plant take, let's say, 2 to 5 years to build a reasonable plant from decision, final decision to actually making product. The power industry works on probably a 10, 15 year horizon. So what we've had since 2007 in this country has been that anybody talking about, I want to build a new heavy industry plant, which is our economy basically, has been told you can't have the power. Now, if you believe in the new version of IPPs and renewables, that shouldn't be an issue. Because I should be able to build my power, my little power station next to my factory. So why is it not happening? With cell phones, they changed the world. Power, the mechanics of power haven't changed over the last 30 years.
And so if you're let's say you're Anglo-American and you need that power when you need it, it may not be when ESCOM's got it, and you now have the ability to generate 100 megawatts of your own power, and you're not doing it, what calculation are you making that makes it not worth it?
The cost of power. I go to somebody, I say, let's take the example. I'm now Anglo-American, I want to build power. So I go and I, in the market, and I say, someone will build me a power station. And they go, yes, someone will build you a power station. Well, first of all, what power stations? Forget that for the second. The first comment will come from the first question. We need a backup contract with ESCOM.
Yeah.
Because I'm building one power station, we could have a bad day. You know, our machine could break for some reason. Be it, even if it's a coal-fired station or if it's a gas station, you've got to have some maintenance regime, so you need to have ESCOM backup. But the other problem is that I need at least 10 years of PPA to make it worth my while to build this thing. I need guarantees.
PPA?
Power purchase agreement. I'm now building your power station. Peter, you're now Anglo-American. I'm building my power station next to your factory for you.
Yeah, okay.
I reckon I'm going to have a payback period of, say, at least 10, maybe 15 years on my plant. That's being optimistic. So you have got to give me a guarantee that you will keep paying my bills for 15 years.
So if I'm Anglo-American, I don't build it myself. I find you to do it for me.
Yeah, and I say, give me a 15-year guarantee.
Yeah.
And you say, not interested. I can't guarantee the market that far ahead. So what actually happens is Anglo-American builds their plant in Outer Mongolia. That's the problem.
But what happens here? What happens here? I mean, when do we, why don't we, in which case, what do we do? Do we pack up and go to Mongolia? I mean, do we leave? Do we shut down? Do we stop dreaming, stop hoping?
No, we change our policy and we start actually building something that will make power. And for all the complaints about Medupi and Kassili, and there clearly there was all the learning problems of building a first of, you know, in essentially a first of the country for many years, we've got to start building plant. I'll give you an example, and I'm being very localized here. One of the few things in the world is, can you raise money to build something? And the nice thing about nuclear power stations is they're like buying brand new motor cars. You know, BMW offers you finance with your motor car. If you build your own motor car, you don't get finance for it. So the nice thing of nuclear is that you'll get finance from a sovereign state. I'll give you a bigger question in terms of transition. Forget about your problem. And Mpumalanga does three things happen in Mpumalanga, in my view, economically. They dig rock out the ground. It's called coal. They burn that rock in power stations. That's called the Eskom power stations. And they grow mealies. Well, if you don't do anything in Mpumalanga, all they'll be doing is growing mealies in 20 years' time. I'm not sure we can write off a province that easily. Perhaps I'm old-fashioned. And putting three solar panels and a wind turbine on top of the debris of Kamati Power Station does not make growing industry. And if you want to manufacture something, then my answer is, so what you do is you, and this comes back to your opening comment about Gwede Mantashe, is, in my opinion, and this is a very personal opinion, you end up building a series of small modular reactors and you end up with a program to replace the current coal fleet in Mpumalanga with a fleet of small nuclear reactors on the same sites, which gives you industry, it keeps the economy growing, and it makes power.
Well, you used to be part of, or if not in charge of, the pebble bed modular reactor that Eskom once owned. And we tossed that into the bin as well.
Yes.
Would it have worked?
Lack of faith in ourselves. Yes. Well, the Chinese just synchronized their first, what you would call a PBMR, to the grid in Shandong province in December.
And where did they get that technology from?
The overall technology has been around for some years in the world, but they were heavily involved with South Africa. I've been over there before now a couple of times to talk to them. I was there in that 2016 to see them. I know them well. And so it's quite likely to it forward with a small, and it's of interest in terms of the whole discussions of small modular reactors, and you heard that discussion knocking around as the new exciting small reactors.
Well, there's a lot of talk in the UK. I think Rolls-Royce is involved with that.
Yeah. But what's interesting is the small modular reactor concept came out of PBMR.
Yeah.
When we first put PBMR on the table as a 100 megawatt machine, we were told by the industry and by the IEA, by the UN body, that you couldn't exist because they decided that large reactors were 1200 megawatts plus, medium reactors were 1200 to 900, and small were 900 to 600, and 100 didn't exist, so we couldn't be a design. So in fact, PBMR from South Africa was essentially the first SMR. The world is looking at small modular reactors across the world now, but the problem is the only one that actually is now synchronized to the grid is some Russian small modular reactors in Siberia and the Chinese high-temperature gas core reactor, the PBMR lookalike. Actually, want to say, you've got to touch something, that's what you're going to touch. The rest are paper studies.
Now, if that's the solution, I mean, how capable are we of making it happen? I mean, the PBMR was a South African concept and a South African innovation. It never got to sort of lift off.
Yeah.
But presumably at the time, there were some pretty clever people working on it. Do they still exist? Are they still here?
Yeah, I mean I'll give you an example. I mean, some examples of South African technique. I mean, there's a US reactor project called X Energy, which is a PBMR lookalike. And its chief technology officer and head of engineering, those two guys are both ex-PBMR people, South Africans. There is Kairos Energy, which is another one which is going forward, which is a similar sort of technology, but it uses a slightly different approach. Its head of engineering is a South African. There is even an American project called, what's it called? UltraSafe Nuclear, USNC, which has its engineering offices in Pretoria, right? So no, we're in the game. And 140 of the engineers that commissioned the new Abu Dhabi reactor from Coburg, because they pay more money. So yes, the skills are there. But the answer today, if someone asked me today, and this is a personal comment, not next, is I'd say the logical thing is to say to someone like Chinese, we want a joint venture to do these things in Africa. Will you help us get it set up? Because they've got the design, they've built it. They've overcome those problems of when you build, like Madupi Kasili, the designs are fundamentally sound, but when you get to put the details get in the way sometimes. And when you've actually done it, you can say, I now know how to do it. And so in a very real sense, you know, getting the Chinese as partners would be the obvious choice there.
But David, now, I mean, as things stand now, official policy, of which Gwede Mantashe is the custodian, is the Integrated Resource Plan, the IRP 2019.
Yeah.
And it plans it plans for almost the opposite of what you're suggesting.
No, it's got 2,500 megawatts of nuclear in there.
Well, but that's simply an extension. That's simply extending the life of Coburg.
No. It's got two things in there. It's got progress the procurement of 2,500 megawatts of new nuclear and continue Coburg 20 years more life.
So on the update, the document that I'm looking at doesn't say that. But okay, let's assume the 1,900 megawatts of Coburg is extended for however long, 2050 or whatever. So there's room in the IRP for how much new nuclear?
Well, that's the stupid thing about the IRP, is it only has a detailed plan, i.e. commissioning dates, up until 2030. Right?
Yeah.
And given it takes at least 10 years for a massive new project, be it hydro or be it big coal or be it nuclear, even be it natural gas in a sense, more than 10 years to come to fruition, then in fact the plan is silent on what really should be being done in the next 10 years. It's talking about the delivery in the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, that must be the diagram that I'm looking at.
And in fact, you'll find the governments, the nurses agreed to the 2,500 megawatts. But nurses' reasons for the decision to support the Section 34 determination for the nuclear 2,500 megawatts explicitly says, forget your modeling for a second, lads. If you want to keep the lights on, you need something which is dispatchable. Let me give you a thought, if I can, Peter. In the last few years, we've seen load shedding, which has crippled us, we think, right? Here's a question for you. What's the highest percentage in any given year of desired power that Eskom hasn't met? In other words, if you take Eskom sales for the year and you work out how much it's load shed, how much is load shed as a percentage of the whole desired amount?
Yeah, I don't know.
Now, what I'm saying is of the sales that Eskom's made, the megawatt hours that Eskom sold to customers, it has shed about 1% in the worst year.
Right.
So in terms of load shedding, right, it's worth bearing in mind how little load shedding we've had to cause catastrophe in the economy.
So come back to nuclear. So nothing, there's nothing in the IRP until 2030. Now, if there's more to come up until 2050, great. It's got to be small modular plants.
Well, it hasn't got to be small. Let me say, if somebody said the government's now got this 2,500 megawatt project DMRE is running, and my best estimate is that, assuming that goes as reasonably fast as it can, not insanely fast, but reasonably fast, the first machine will be on stream about 2032. That's the scale of big projects. Same as the coal station, and I believe natural gas wouldn't be that far ahead of it, oddly enough, of big size.
So the IRP records a decision to commence preparations for a build nuclear program.
Yes.
How far is that? Where is that now? Do you know?
That is at a state where the ministers issued a request to NERSA for a Section 34 determination. NERSA has had a public participation process and has agreed to the Section 34 with a couple of caveats that are very which are not significant. I mean, they're significant, but they're not difficult to meet.
What is Section 34?
Section 34 is the approval of NERSA that we can – the minister issues an edict called a Section 34 determination. We will build this kind of power station. So
Okay.
Whenever, when the RMIPP came out, for example, there was a Section 34 determination by the minister which said, we will do this.
Yeah.
And to do that, Section 34, he has to have the agreement or the consultation with NERSA. So that's the, and that was the thing which tripped up the nuclear in 2017, because the judge said, my interpretation of that is that you should not have done it without public participation. It's going forward, and minister has publicly stated in his speeches that he intends to issue the request for proposals by the end of this financial year. That is by March. It might be a few months later, I think, but that's the intention.
And that would be proposals for nuclear plant up to the capacity of 2,500 megawatts.
That's what it says. Yes. Which would logically, conceivably be, and again, if you're asking for my opinion, and I must be careful, this is Dave Nichols' opinion, not...
Absolutely. No, I'm asking for your opinion.
Yeah, I would assume that the obvious thing to do would be to put two more 1,000-megawatt machines at Cobourg to support the Western Cape, because since Cobourg's been built, the demand there has doubled, and the Western Cape is now in tide, depending on the power lines down from the Highveld. And also to build the first of class of a small modular reactor as the beginning of a program to roll out small modular reactors to replace the coal fleet as they come off.
So two new units at Cobourg would be roughly 900 each, yeah?
Probably about 1,100.
Each?
Each, yes. Because Cobourg's being re-rated. When Cobourg was sent out 900 megawatts a few years ago. We changed the steam turbines, that moved into 930. When they bring it back with the new steam generators, it'll be 965 each. And when they uprate the plant by 10%, which is the plan and is currently modeled, then it'll be something like 1,050 megawatts a unit.
Yeah, your remaining sort of requirement in the range given then would be about 300 megawatts for...
Yeah.
Whatever mini nuclear.
And that will be slightly more at risk. The ones in Cape Town will be very simple. They'll be sort of, I mean, not simple, but they'll be, you buy it off the shelf, you get guarantees, no debate. And you get a PPA for those and they cover the costs. And then you do the same thing with the SMR, but it'll be slightly more risk in that because it is reasonably new technology coming out in terms of deployment.
Do we write off renewables completely then? I mean, they're just simply not a viable way forward. We in terms of base load, we look after nuclear, we build some more coal, and we're going to add some gas into that mix as well, I presume.
My reading is that, I'm sorry, if I can explain where renewables come in the market, because it's important. If you build a renewable system, you've got to match it with a backup system for when the renewables aren't working. That's straightforward, right? So you've got system A, which is the renewables, and system B, which is the backup. And the trouble you've got is that therefore the renewables are competing with the avoidable costs, the operating costs, the avoidable fuel cost of the backup. So if the backup is nuclear, then you end up with renewables don't compete. So yes, my personal view is renewables don't make sense in any market and haven't done in the world as a whole. No one's made them work in that sense yet. Ask the Germans.
And David, but that would ignore possible innovations and advances in battery technology, I presume.
Well, battery technology has now got to a stage where the cost of your battery is about 80% the cost of the materials going into it, the lithium, the cobalt, and so on. So the battery costs are currently rising in the world, and you've learned as much as we can on the manufacturing and on the IP side of that. So what's happening with batteries is the battery costs. And I'll put a simple answer to you. Peter, do you drive a motor car?
Yes, I do.
I will argue very simply that if you look at your motor car companies are very cost competitive and they're prepared to do really high-tech things if they need to. In your motor car, there is a black box called a battery. Yes?
Yeah, Bob.
It is lead acid, invented in 1859. So Toyota is saying the cheapest battery in the world today that we can buy to put in your motor car is actually an 1859 development. And they build lots of those.
One of the problems for me, people sort of, you know, ordinary folk like me talking to people who are experts like you and any experts in renewable energy, experts in traditional sources of energy, you never agree on anything, you know. And I have a report here from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation quoting the Australian Energy Council last week, And it says that that a typical Australian residential electricity bill is 8% lower in 2021 than it was in 1819 because of renewables. So where's the lie in there? Where's the trick in that? If they're saying that renewables have done that.
The trick is very simple. When you've got a model, any model, I'm adding a model, then what you've got to do is somehow put real world data and see if your model with real world data gives the real world answer. And then you can talk about changing the data to give you what your changes will do for you. So my answer is, please show me anywhere in the world where a low cost grid has got unsubsidized renewables in it. It doesn't exist. It's a bit like Germany, where Germany is supposedly the solution to renewables, and they've got five and ten times the CO2 emissions of France, and a cost that is like 50% higher than France.
Well, that's the price of buying Russian gas as well, surely.
No, the Russian gas is quite cheap. There's a whole gas discussion will go on for hours, and we used half an hour, I think.
Okay.
But I'll come back on that one. But the answer to the question is that if you're going to tell me that renewables are the solution, then my answer is you don't need a policy document. When cell phones came in 1994, the big question was for MTN and Vodacom was, could we get enough LSM 8 and 9 users to justify the cell towers going up? If you had told them in 1994 that your gardener would have one, your domestic would have two, and your domestic's grandson would have one, they would tell you out of your skull. But the reality is the whole technology of telecoms has changed because of technology with no policy decisions. Central Africa runs cell phone systems and no landlines. And that wasn't a policy decision. It didn't need policy. It just happened because of it. So excuse me, if that's the case, then why are we even discussing centralized power systems if renewables are that good?
You know, thank you, David. And as usual, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I wish I could be sitting opposite you in a table, because we'd have a pint after this. But
vital discussion. We may still do that sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still on my New Year abstinence plan, but I'll get there. I'll get to the end of it soon.
I'm not meeting you until you've got off that discussion.
Not until the end of February, but nonetheless, the thing that I wanted to ask is about technology and about the speed at which things change. You know, batteries look ridiculous now because they're full of flammable liquids and you know, are heavy and expensive. But what if they change? I mean, if you were, you know, the day before the Wright brothers first flew an aeroplane, people would have said it was impossible.
Yeah.
And the next day it wasn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that's quite as, because people knew flying was possible. We had these indoor birds. But I'll put an answer to you. Yes, if someone invents something new, there's two things you talk about. One is development, where you can say, I know where this technology is going. I can hypothesize where it'll be in 5 years' time. And that's one discussion. But the other discussion is someone's going to invent something new. And I've no doubt when something new comes out, the world will change. So you're saying cheap batteries, about one-fifth to one-tenth their cost, where they really break through in a big way. No one's showing any way of getting there, but maybe someone will invent it next week. It's about as likely, but my view, it's less likely than fusion is to take off, which is, we know how fusion works. We just can't quite make it work at the moment. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because what you see in history is that when a technology takes off, it takes off incredibly quickly. I'll give you two examples that are very real. Natural gas in 1989 was an exotic material, and we couldn't get no one built combined cycle gas turbines. 10 years later, 85% of all the new generating plant in the world were combined cycle gas turbines. It was that fast the world changed. Nuclear went from being esoteric in 65 to, by 1980, it was the biggest, on an annual basis, it was the biggest installed capacity going in every year. So it can change. Bring us the technology, it'll change. But at the moment, we must work what we've got today and what we can reasonably project in the future.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you very much for joining me, you, the listeners. I really appreciate that, and I hope you enjoyed David Nichols. It's not often that we get to give time and space to the sort of establishment and the established view, but I think it was important to hear the sort of unadulterated case for traditional energy sources, and I'm glad that David Nichols was able to join us. I've become really quite engrossed with the climate story, and if you don't mind, over the next couple of episodes of Podcasts from the Edge, I want to talk to more people involved in it all. I'll be back next week, and meanwhile, you take care of yourselves, be safe, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.